What happened to Dolly?
Dolly went to a breeding project. I'm trying to remember. I think it was in Washington State. A guy had a male, and I had this female who was real well adapted to being with people. So she went out there and raised a bunch of baby falcons that got released on buildings and in cities and on cliffs. And so it's a happy story, that part of it.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Dan O'Brien about his classic nonfiction book, The Rites of Autumn, a falconer's journey across the American West. We also delve into his life as a buffalo rancher in South Dakota. This interview was made possible with the generous support of the Norman McLean Festival. Stay with us. Your journey with Dolly began in your attempt to release her to the wild and restore peregrine populations. She survived an attack by a golden eagle, and you set out to prepare her for the wild release back in the Gulf of Mexico at the fall migration. And initially in the book, during the release process, you address your own guilt. I can't help thinking that if I'd done better, three falcons would still be alive, you wrote. And I was wondering, what's the relationship for you between stewardship as a human and population restoration and those moments when we fail or flub or mess up?
Well, of course, we have failed, flubbed, and messed up a lot. In fact, it's kind of our modus operandi as humans. And in this book, it really describes a special time in my life and actually a special time in restoration biology. And I was just a technician, really. But I was fortunate enough to be in on the repatriation of peregrine falcons in the Rocky Mountain. It was a special time because it was a group of people who we really had a mission and we thought we were doing something important, which we were. The job was impossible. Mm-hmm. And so it was not surprising that we often failed, flubbed up, etc. In this case, you have to realize that nature is a tough, tough mother. Mm-hmm. When you really work in biology, you have to leave your human sympathies behind. And that's the most difficult part. It really, really is. I mean, the loss of a peregrine falcon, a young peregrine falcon, in the big picture, is nothing.
Right.
Nothing. But it breaks your heart. And so you just have to steel yourself for those kind of moments. And that book is full of those kind of moments. And I didn't know it at the time, but it became kind of a theme in that book. What I learned from that is that the idea of species-specific restoration is a fool's errand. It's not about the individual. It's about the species, and the species is about the habitat. And so if I learned that during that time and in that book, it was a good lesson. And I've spent the rest of my life trying to push that lesson on to other people.
I can't wait to talk about how that has shown up in the last 20 years for you later in the interview, but I'm really tempted to stick with some falconry bits because it's a world I know nothing about. And this book is full of terms like hacking and jesses and creons. And I was wondering, can you define some of these terms and explain what is the methodology of falconry?
You know, it's really interesting that you would talk about those things, because this morning, you know, I was up early. I get up pretty early, but it was maybe 4:30 when I went outside, and I had to take care of the dogs and take care of the falcons before I left to fly here. And we were just starting to get, the sun wasn't coming up yet. We were starting to get that beautiful muted morning light. And I had put the falcons in their chambers last night, and I had hung all their equipment up on a board that I have outside in the weathering yard that we call it. And there were, you know, my glove, the Jesses, the swivel, the leashes were all hanging on this board with that light on. And I actually took a picture of it with my phone and sent it to some friends. That's part of falconry. It's the stuff,
yeah,
you know.
Like a good angler, right?
Yeah, it's a lot like a fly rod, or, you know, my dad had these antique fly rods. And I've thought about that today, because I think I've seen more fly rods today since I got off the airplane than I've seen for a couple of years. But, you know, he had all these old reels and bamboo rods and stuff like that. And I loved that stuff. Mm-hmm. And falconry is full of that kind of thing. There's also a huge literature behind falconry. I mean, going back to French and early English, you know, in just about every country, Chinese and Japanese falconry, it's an old, old tradition. And I've been fortunate enough to travel a little bit around the world. It seems every place I go, if you dig, hang out long enough with guys that hunt and people that are interested in that sort of thing, you come to some old fool that's got a falcon. And he knows all the history of his area and all the differences in the equipment and the minutiae of the sport.
How did you originally get into it?
I grew up in Ohio. And I had a cousin who was sort of known as being a bit of a renegade. He was a lineman for the county. He climbed poles, so he could really climb trees. And he climbed up a tree and got a red-tailed hawk and started trying to catch rabbits with a red-tailed hawk. And I was 10 or something, and I became fascinated by it. In a way, I was never a great student, but that's how I learned to read, to really seriously read, was by reading old falconry books. And there's hundreds of them. There's hundreds of them. Mm-hmm. You know, he had an old book called The Art and Practice of Falconry by Frederick the Great. It's a huge 1,000-page book, which, you know, a 10-year-old kid, especially this 10-year-old kid, was daunted by. But I read the whole thing, you know. That was my introduction. And then the next year, my cousin brought down a red tail for me, and that was 60 some years ago. And I've had a falcon, I think, every year since. So I've had a lot of birds and have really in some ways designed my life around it. I, you know, now I live on a ranch. Really, the idea of the ranch is there's, I don't know, 15 or 20 duck ponds on there, and I'm able to massage the land to raise more grouse and et cetera, et cetera. And in the fall and winter, I'm out pretty much every day with a falcon.
When I think about intimate relationships between humans and animals, obviously the things that come to mind are dogs and horses. So I want to understand from you, because you also, you have hunting dogs, and I imagine you have other kinds of animals, working animals on this ranch. What is different about having a bird as a companion or as a hunting partner?
I do. I'm a big dog person. I've got 5 dogs, and most of them sleep with me every night. And, you know, I got walking horses and lots of buffalo, and there's animals everywhere. But you ask what the difference is between those animals and a falcon, and the easy answer is that they can fly.
Yeah.
And it's unbelievable. I mean, and you know, when you spend as much time outside as I do, which is a lot, too much, you start to notice things, and you find yourself saying, you know, what I do in the morning is I step outside to see which way the wind's blowing. And okay, and is it cold? Is it warm? Is it barometer going up, down? All those things are interesting to me and important to my life. And a falcon does that instantly.
Yeah.
She knows exactly where the wind's coming from, so she can get upwind and get that advantage of if quarry does flush. You know, those kind of things make them very, very special. And where I live, which is the Great Plains, there aren't very many trees. There are very, very few trees. We have thousands of acres without any trees on it. But it's a land of birds, and it's a land of vision. I mean, these birds can see, you know, I'd be looking at my falcon drifting away with binoculars. She's probably 3-4 miles away, and I pull something out of my pocket, and she'll turn right around and come. It's almost unbelievable.
Yeah.
But it happens every day, and it happens, you know, and then of course there's the wild ones. You know, they're a souped up version of the tame ones because they fly every day. They're hard, and they're doing the same thing. It's not, the meat isn't coming out of somebody's pocket. It's a little bird flicking a wing a mile away. And that stuff is fascinating to me.
Yeah. The word godliness came to my mind.
You know, it's that whole vision thing. They really are in control and completely aware of their surroundings.
Yeah. You mentioned the landscape, and you address the sagebrush landscape in the book. And I want to know if you can tell listeners why it's valuable and why it has been at risk by humans.
That is such a huge topic, and I look at that discussion as really metaphorical, because every landscape, every corner of the world is under that kind of pressure and under that kind of attack, really. The sagebrush country, which I think the stuff I was talking about actually is in Montana. That stuff, I was up there a few years ago. It's all in wheat now.
Yeah.
And you take an ecosystem with probably 150 plant species and maybe another 100 bird and mammal species, and you purposely turn it into a monoculture of wheat, you have done more damage than anybody could ever do with any other device. You strike it right where they live, yeah, literally. You know, as a metaphor for the world itself, I think that's exactly what's happening to the world.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Dan O'Brien about his classic 1988 book, The Rites of Autumn, A Falconer's Journey Across the American West. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. There's a passage in the book where you meditate on how you decided to live where you live, and I'm just going to read this to you and have you respond to it now. You write, 17 years before, I had decided to call this area home. I had made the decision gravely after spending an entire day in a university library. From climatic charts, demographic tables, old geological survey maps, and economic forecasts, I narrowed down the possibilities. I took this decision very seriously because, in a way, it was the first time I had had such a privilege. And then you write about landing in this landscape, you say, when I stepped out of the pickup and looked at the house and landscape that most people would say was too desolate, I knew I was home. And it's been home for 50 years?
Been home for 50 years, yeah. It's still home, and it's, I know that almost all of us have this sensation, but it's tragic because I haven't been to Missoula for 20 years, okay? And yeah, there's a lot of neat new stuff here in Missoula, but is it really worth what's been lost? Yeah, the river's great, the restoration, that's all fine. But do we really need another housing development? Do we really need, you know, another superhighway going through town? Do we really need another 50,000 people? I mean, the answer to me is clearly no. Mm-hmm. I think that the world has been diminished more than it's been enhanced.
This passage came to me at a time in my life when I'm sitting with these questions, and I'm sort of shocked that you had been doing this, you know, 50 years ago, that here I am going, where is a safe, interesting place to learn the land? Do you have any recommendations then for us billions of people trying to figure out where's home?
If I had any recommendations, I wouldn't tell you because I'd be afraid you'd go there. It's interesting to me because, you know, I went to an undergraduate degree in a little college in Ohio. It was a funny time. The draft was breathing down my neck, and it was a wild time. And I was the chairman of the first Earth Day on our campus. The things that people are talking about now are the same things we were talking about then. There weren't very many of us talking about those things. And there are more people talking about them now. And I wonder, I think like everyone, if it's too late. I mean, I think that we are a race of time. You know, can we change our ways before we ruin everything? Or before we ruin anything? Any species that's lost is an unreconcilable disaster to me. We'd give little tours of our ranch. And twice this summer, I'm out in an ATV with husband and wife and two kids. And twice, I had an older couple with me. The man, pretty silent Midwesterner guys. The woman was with us, of course. And both of them told me, or the one told me, that he's quiet because he's sad. And these are tough guys.
Yeah.
These are farmers from, one was from, I think, Indiana, and one from Wisconsin. We were driving around, and there were meadowlarks. We have thousands of meadowlarks on our ranch. And I just, by matter of course, you know, a bird gets up, and I try to name it, and I say, there's a meadowlark. Oh, there's a couple more meadowlarks. And I look over, and these guys, probably in their 70s, my age, actually have tears running down their cheeks. And the reason, as related by their wives, was he knows what he's done to the land. These guys plowed it up, and the one guy said, I haven't seen a meadowlark for 20 years.
Wow.
And they know that they're culpable, and it's the saddest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. So for the past 20 years, you've been ranching buffalo, which, you know, you said earlier, single species restoration is a fool's errand, but keystone species restoration, or working with them on the natural landscape, seems to suit you.
That's true. I mean, it's absolutely true. And we are not, Ray, and when I say we, that's me and I have a wife. We live separately on the ranch. We found out that works a lot better. And then we have a daughter, which is not my daughter. It's her daughter. I don't have any children. Incidentally, that's a promise I made in 1970 on the first Earth Day.
It was a moral decision then.
Yeah. But we are not raising, we don't look at it as raising buffalo. We look at it as developing and protecting the suite of species that was there. I have a friend that told me one time, we were having a discussion like I have seems like every day, about all the problems. And I said, well, this thing is that, and that thing's that. And he stopped me, and he said, you know, Dan, there's only one thing. And I think that if you look at a piece of land, especially the Great Plains, it's not the buffalo, it's not the peregrine falcon, it's not the meadowlark, it's not the western wheatgrass or the needlegrass. It's all one thing. And every species is diminished with the loss of one. And we can't say, well, you know, we've lost half the species, but it's still a good ecosystem. It's not. It's wounded. It's crippled. And there's only one person to point the finger at, and that's us. And it's us personally. It's you. It's me. We have too many people, and we use too much stuff. Mm-hmm. Period.
On your website, you call yourself a carbon cowboy. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. I've been raving about carbon for a long time and realizing what a healthy ecosystem does. Almost every ecosystem sequesters a lot of carbon. The Great Plains sequester an immense amount. I get different scientists saying different things, but some say that the Great Plains, the grasses on the Great Plains, can sequester as much carbon as the rainforest. The rainforest gets a little fire, everybody gets upset. Every day, there's tens of thousands of acres plowed up on the Great Plains. It's a real tragedy. So a few years ago, we've been doing this buffalo thing, and we raise our buffalo in such a way that we like to have 35 acres per buffalo. And we like to sort of just roughly figure that every buffalo should be able to walk 3 miles a day without covering the same ground, okay? And that's just, we pulled those figures out of our head. So Yvon Chouinard, who, if you don't know who Yvon Chouinard is, you should know, because he's a real thought leader. He owns Patagonia Company. He writes pretty good books, actually. He decided that one of the things that Patagonia should do is have a line of food, because really a lot of these problems that we're talking about can be traced back to food. So he had his people sort of nose around who produces ecologically neutral buffalo meat. And we're the only people that do it. Mm-hmm. Everybody else, almost everybody else, sends their buffalo to feedlots, which is a whole nother subject. But feedlots are bad. We need to get rid of those. And we talked with his people. We said, geez, we're just a little company. We can't do Patagonia jerky. And so he came out. It turns out that we have a lot of friends in common, okay? And a lot of writers. I mean, McGuane and Harrison and all those guys are friends of his also. We hit it off. He was an old falconer. Didn't know that. So he said, well, look, we can help you. What do you need? I said, oh, we need another smoker, and we need this, and we need that. And he said, we can help you with that stuff. So we went into business with Patagonia, and their PR people are the people that came up with calling me the carbon cowboy. I didn't have anything to do with it. So there you have it.
So there you have it. Okay. That's great. Dan, we'll start to wind down, but there are two places in the book I want to return to. One of my favorite passages in the book is about driving at night. This is interesting because we're coming off of a carbon comment, but you write, the hum of the highway beneath the tires of the pickup soothed me, and I soon fell into that familiar and pleasant trance that comes with night travel in a motor vehicle. It has occurred to me that this state might be addictive. I know people, and indeed am one myself, who, when things aren't exactly going right, feel the need to jump into a pickup and drive several hundred miles in one direction or the other. Do you still do that?
I'm an American Midwest boy. There's something about a pickup truck and going. You know, it's an American phenomenon that we seem to need that for our psyche, to be going. That's very American. And yeah, like this morning, you know, I was saying I got up early, and you know, I had a million things that I should be doing this weekend, and I wasn't going to come to this thing. But when I got up this morning at 4:30, I was so excited to get going.
To hit the road.
To get going, to hit the road. So, yeah, I think, you know, we have our frailties.
The other thing I made note of in the book is you write about dreams, which seemed a bit in contrast to some of the more real grounded natural elements. And I want to know, what do you dream about now?
I do dream and I daydream a lot. To be honest with you, most of my dreams are not that happy now. I really feel a certain dread about where we are politically and environmentally and socially. You know, those dreams do wake me up at night. I tune in public radio about 4 o'clock in the morning and I get better.
Dan, is there anything else as you look back in the rear view at Rites of Autumn that you want to share?
Just that this story of the Rites of Autumn, I mean, it's an autobiographical chunk of my life, and everybody has a little autobiography in them. I think that if you pay attention to the things that really, truly give you pleasure, not the Facebook post, but those meadowlarks that we were talking about, I think that you will find that you have a little bit deeper respect and a little deeper love for this whole world. And we all need that.
Dan O'Brien has been a wildlife biologist and rancher for more than 30 years. He's also one of the most celebrated falconers in America today and was a prime mover in the restoration of peregrine falcons in the Rocky Mountains in the 1970s and 80s. Dan's latest nonfiction book is Wild Idea, Buffalo and Family in a Difficult Land. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.